the end of 2025, is DeepSeek leading the state of the art in artificial intelligence? Abraham Daniels is a senior technical product manager with Granite. Abraham, welcome back to the show, joining us for the second time. What do you think?
They're definitely making a splash in the open source space, but you know, it's a really competitive landscape. So I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Qatar El Megrawi is a principal research scientist and manager at the AI Hardware Center. Qatar, I feel like you're becoming a regular here on the show. What's your take on this question?
DeepSeek is definitely reshaping the AI landscape, challenging giants with open source ambition and state-of-the-art innovations. But talking about leading, I think that remains to be seen. It's not just about the raw performance, but it's also about the whole integration.
And finally, last but not least, is Skylar Speakman, who is a senior research scientist. Skylar, welcome back. What is your take?
Amazing technology, great splash, as we said earlier. But I think there's really some really big geopolitics at play on how these models really get developed and are used across the world.
All right, all that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE is the place to tune into to hear the news and analysis on some of the biggest headlines and trends in artificial intelligence. Today, we're going to cover quite a lot as per usual. We're going to talk about Mistral potentially going IPO, a controversy around the Frontier Math benchmark, and a recent interesting IDC report on generalized versus specialized coding assistance. But first, I want to start with DeepSeek. So just this past last week or so, DeepSeek released R1. And if you recall and you're a listener to the show, you know that just a few episodes ago, I believe we were talking about DeepSeek V3, which is their release, which at the time, I think kind of blew everybody's mind, where they were showing really, really incredible performance with incredibly sort of less compute and cost than what we're traditionally used to in the AI space. And with R1, it basically is DeepSeek's pretty fast on its heels release, showing that it has performance comparable with kind of state-of-the-art stuff coming out of OpenAI, specifically to wit, O1 and kind of the inference compute sort of techniques that really seem to give it a bunch of benefit for that model. And so I guess maybe Abraham, I'll start with you. Do you want to talk us through a little bit about like why this is a big deal? Because I remember when, you know, O1 was released, people were like, this is a huge innovation and, you know, really shows that OpenAI has this big technological edge. Pretty soon afterwards, it seems like DeepSeek's doing almost the same thing, though. So I don't know if you want to talk our listeners to, like, how do they do that? How do they catch up so quickly?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think there's kind of two things that are really cool here. One is, of course, just, you know, the comparative performance with, you know, a state-of-the-art kind of leading-edge, bleeding-edge model like O1. But unlike O1, it's been pretty cool that DeepSeeker has decided to open source it, which, you know, has been able to kind of proliferate some pretty powerful models across the community without the blockage or, you know, added need for a commercial license. So I think they're really kind of shifting the paradigm, given a lot of these model providers are starting to slap on more, you know, specific licenses that are tailored to more commercial practices, given, you know, the business model that they're in. So I think it kind of shifts the idea of, you know, what does it mean to be transparent? What does it mean to be open without having to risk performance?
Skylar, it strikes me a little bit that, like, I think when we've talked about this issue in the past, you know, we've really talked about it in terms of, you know, OpenAI versus Meta, you know, right? And Meta's trying to kind of go compete with OpenAI by releasing these incredibly powerful models open source. This almost feels like now, like, everybody's after OpenAI exactly the same way. And obviously the distinction here, which is pretty interesting, is, you know, DeepSeek is not a kind of classic player. It's not a big tech player. So do you want to speak a little bit to that? I know you kind of mentioned that, like, you think the competitive dynamics here are really interesting to watch.
Yeah. So first off, I think we'll get to the competitive dynamics in a bit, but reinforcement learning back on the scene. And I know it kind of died out for a while when deep neural networks really took over, but there now are multiple companies, and I think DeepSeek is an example of making it quite public, of bringing this back into the large language models. So cool to see these ebbs and tides of various parts of AI and machine learning come and go. So that's kind of more on the technology side. It's really cool to see some of these things pop back up.
Yeah, totally. And I guess a quick comment on that. I mean, I think it is funny that, you know, for DeepMind, right, which originally made its bet on reinforcement learning. I think the rhetoric of the last year was, they made the wrong bet and now they're trying to catch up. And now it's like, were they just really, really far ahead of everybody else? Like, I don't know.
Yes, no, great comment. There was this big push in reinforcement learning before, I think, the transformer, basically. And now these things seem to be, I'd say cohabitating, or at least being in the same technology. DeepSeek has shown that they can put both of those techniques into the same package. And I think that is a really compelling argument for their strength going into 2025.
Catherine, maybe I'll turn to you. I know out of the kind of set of folks on the panel, you know, I think you sounded the most cautious about DeepSeek. I think there's one point of view which is, oh man, they're releasing V3. That's incredible. Not like a month or so later, you know, oh my God, now they're releasing R1. You know, they're catching up so quickly. I guess there's a way the human mind is just like, well, if we continue these trends, then, you know, AGI by the end of the year from DeepSeek. Do you want to speak a little bit about why you're still ultimately kind of skeptical that, you know, DeepSeek, this is like the arrival of a genuine deep challenger to something like OpenAI?
Yes, I think the key question is, what advancements does R1 introduce compared to V3, and how does it compare to O1? Are we talking about incremental changes or really like true innovations and new things that are leapfrogging the AI community? So they're claiming that they're improving the search precision, the scalability, the usability, while their V3 release focused on optimizing the core algorithms. So they're saying that R1 has capabilities, you know, such as better contextual understanding, and especially for these complex reasoning tasks, which makes it competitive kind of toe-to-toe with O1. So I think we need still to test these models to see really where they're there, because this is a new release, so it still remains to be tested and to see what capabilities they're really bringing to the table and how do they really compare with O1. I mean, they're showing some of the benchmark that sometimes, you know, they exceed O1. So I think it's something that needs to be validated. But one thing that I'm a bit skeptical about is, you know, I think O1 still benefits from their proprietary integration with enterprise grade features, which R1 might lack. So, and that's something that still needs to be tested and evaluated. So, and another thing is, what's the broader implications, you know, in this rapid integration for open source ecosystems? You know, the release cycles are, it's pretty impressive, very fast cycles. And, you know, this release space showcases the power also of community-driven innovations. However, maintaining quality while scaling adoption remains a challenge here. And, you know, the open nature of DeepSeek could accelerate AI democratization. And it's also challenging the big players like OpenAI. So, and putting, you know, kind of pressures, especially that they're coming with very competitive pricing, much cheaper compared to O1 or OpenAI's pricing. So I think it still remains to be validated whether we're really talking about true innovation that goes, you know, kind of hand in hand with what O1 is doing or even better. So that needs to be still validated. But I still think, you know, the fine tuning capabilities, the integration with the enterprise use cases, that probably are still lacking there.
Yeah, for sure. I guess, Abraham, that's like a very natural place, I think, to turn to you. You know, what I hear in Kautar's argument is kind of the idea that the models are going to become kind of more commodity with time, and sort of the competitive edge is integration, right? Which is, well, OpenAI can kind of win now because it's like hooked into all these other types of systems. And that's actually where the advantage is. As someone who's working on Granite, is that kind of how you see the market? Or I'm kind of curious what your response to all that.
Yeah, I think there's the kind of two people that we gear towards. There's the commercial users, you know, where, you know, they're really focused on enterprise use cases, ensuring that there's proper governance wrapped around the model and indemnification and just that safety and support. And then there's the open source developers that, in my opinion, kind of dictate what is the best on the, you know, outside of benchmarks, which, you know, to Kator's point is not always exactly what it seems. Your developer community really dictates what the best is given what the adoption rate is. So I think over here at Granite, you know, we're focused on open source. So I think DeepSeek is a phenomenal play in terms of being able to open up the aperture when it comes to some of the most performant models on the market. And honestly, I'm looking forward to kind of seeing what comes from this in terms of the learnings that are shared and, you know, how developers in the community actually start to use O1 to start to, you know, develop new ways creating, to your point, like applications and spaces where this model can perform.
Yeah, I think really to truly lead, you know, LLMs or these, you know, large language models need to move just beyond the raw benchmarking performance. And to really reach true innovations, you have to innovate across efficiency, ethical framework, specialized adaptability, ecosystem support. So pushing the boundaries, not just in AI, but also how it's going to transform human interactions, technology, enterprise applications. So it's really a story about end-to-end integration while being safe, being ethical. So that's, you know, when you really can claim true leadership in the AI space. So a full story of integration, not just looking at the benchmark performance. Benchmark performance is, I'm not saying it's not important, that's important, but I think integrating it full end to end and meeting all the regulations, safety, and the ethical considerations will be really important to drive adoption, wide scale adoption.
And if I may just add, the release of the DeepSeeker did come along with a number of distilled versions. So just to the point of adoption, like, you know, the 650 billion model is not going to fit everywhere in terms of compute use, you know, availability. So the fact that DeepSeeker understood that in order to adopt the model, you have to have, you know, different weight classes for different use cases, I think that just adds to, you know, their story as well.
Yeah, totally. Sounds like Skylar wants to get in. I think Skylar also, before your response, if I can prompt you a little bit, is distillation. You should explain a little bit what distillation is, because I think it is super important. It's going to totally change a lot of the competitive dynamics in the space. But, you know, even I have kind of like the barest understanding of what it is. So I think probably you should start with an explanation of like, what does it mean that they've released a bunch of distilled models? And then you should do whatever hot take you're going to do.
So. All right. I'll try not to get into lecture mode too much. Knowledge distillation is when a much larger, probably much more complex model is used as a target for a smaller or less capable model. So what do I mean by a target? Hopefully our users understand the idea of the next token prediction task, right? You have to complete the rest of the sentence. Knowledge distillation doesn't care quite as much about predicting the next token, but rather taking a smaller model and asking it to match the internal representation of a larger model. So before that larger model gives its answer, it has its own internal representation of the answer. Now we are tasking the smaller model to match that representation rather than making a prediction of another token. And actually last year, Llama showed great results of getting Llama 3.2, I believe, smaller through knowledge distillation. But what's different here is they are now fine-tuning a Llama-based model, but the larger one is coming from DeepSeek. So this is kind of a, you know, spending across different companies here and different ways of training the original DeepSeek model. Way too large to actually run in a lot of circumstances. But as part of this release, they also have Llama-based models that have been fine-tuned as guided or as distilled from the DeepSeek model. And I think that's something that was a very, very smart play because people are used to kind of the Llama sizes and you can Llama APIs, and these seem to be plug and play with those existing tools already. So knowledge distillation is a way of taking a much larger, much more complex model and using it to guide the training process of a smaller model that uses a lot less VRAM and makes a lot of the users much happier.
Yeah, I think I like the analogy of the teacher-student model. Think of the big model as a teacher and the smaller models as a student. And they're just trying to mimic, like Skylar said, the internal representation and mimic the final answers while still having much smaller footprint.
So I'm going to move us on to our next topic. Mistral, the French open source AI company, was recently appeared at the World Economic Forum happening in Davos, and sort of after much rumors confirmed that they were not attempting to sell the company or be acquired, but instead would be pushing for IPO. And I think it's kind of a nice opportunity to talk about Mistral because, you know, I remember like many moons ago, and by that I mean, I don't know, 18 months ago, Mistral was like the thing that everybody was talking about in terms of open source AI. And candidly, we haven't really heard from them in some time, right? Like we haven't talked about Mistral at all in the last, say, 10 episodes of Mixture of Experts. And open source seems to have appeared to become much more dominated, say, by Meta. And I guess the question I wanted to kind of ask the panel first is, you know, is open source really Meta's game right now? Or is there kind of a chance for these kind of like earlier players that really moved along open source AI in a really big way in kind of the early innings of this game? You know, do they still have a fighting chance here, or is it really kind of Meta's game in some way? And Abraham, maybe I'll toss it to you. I'm curious about what you think about that.
I mean, in short, I don't think it's only Meta's game. So the most recent Llama license, although it allows for open source, there are some intricacies in terms of, you know, you do have to, the model nomenclature has to include Llama. So they do still wrap some, you know, restrictions around how you use their model, especially if you're, you know, an IBM or a different model developer that wants to distill, you know, DeepSeeker into Llama. So I think the market is still open. IBM is 100% committed to open source. Our entire roadmap will ensure that our dense models and our ML models are released on Hugging Face, fully open source under Apache 2 licensing. So I think the market is still, the field's still kind of open to you know, who wants to lead that charge. And just based on our last conversation, you know, obviously DeepSeeker now entering the space with, you know, extremely high performant model. I think right now it's just like, you know, who's committed to it more so than, you know, who owns it right now.
Skylar, do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I'm rooting for them. I think I don't know, living in the global majority, I do pay more attention about where these models come from. And so I am rooting for models coming from EU or any of kind of the kind of non-traditional large players. So I great to see them, you know, not at least being up for sale. You know, we'll see how long that stays out. But yeah, it was really cool to see that statement. And again, rooting for models that are coming from as diverse parts of the world as possible. And so I'm still holding out for Mistral to still represent large parts of the world.
Yeah, of course. Because I think that is a big part I did want to bring up is the global majority and kind of the geography of all this, right? I mean, we talked about DeepSeek, right? China. Mistral for a long time is kind of considered like, oh, okay, Europe's also going to have its kind of open source player in the space. And so, yeah, I think it is exciting. I guess, Skylar, to kind of push you a little bit further, you know, do you think that different countries, different regions of the world will produce very different kinds of models, right? Like, I guess that's kind of the thing that you might be suggesting here, but I don't know if that's what you imply.
Should they or could they might be the key difference there. I think if they could, they would have yet. I think it is proving much more difficult to kind of have kind of, you know, these efforts scale across the country. And it's also why I think two countries have really dominated this space. So I would like to see more of that. Again, why I would be a Mistral a fan. I think it would take lots of investments from governments, from universities, if that money exists, to really push that type of homegrown effort of models. And I don't really see that now. That's why, again, Mistral, stay strong, still represent other parts of the world.
Definitely, yeah. So, Kautar, are you going to buy into the Mistral IPO?
I think it's a great strategic move by Mistral. So, you know, especially it's great for the European startups ecosystem because they often face these challenges around scaling due to limited venture capital compared to what we see in the US. So the Mistral's IPO will test really whether Europe can foster this globally competitive AI companies. And of course, you know, I think it's important not to have this centralization just, you know, between US and China. It's good also to see other countries, you know, Middle East and Europe and also contributing models. I think going to the question you had, whether we're going to see different models coming from different regions, there might be some nuances there. For example, the cultural implications or the language, the, you know, all these things, maybe some of these regions might tailor their models to their specific cultures, their specific traditions, focus more on incorporating, you know, their languages also in terms of the APIs and answering questions and things like that, which would be great. But of course, for general questions and so on, there will be commonalities, but I think there might be also some regionalizations that might happen in the future.
Yeah, for sure. I think that'll be so interesting because I think it'll, you know, I mean, there's almost nothing mysterious about it. It's almost like, okay, if you're based in a country, you may think to use certain data sets that people in other countries may not think to use, right? And like that'll actually have a material effect on the behavior of the model. And so, you know, I think there's like these really kind of interesting aspects of like, oh, what would you choose to use, you know, if you're based in France versus, you know, Menlo Park, California. And I think that that's a really interesting twist of it.
And even I think the way that the model responds to you, for example, maybe the tone of the language, whether you want it to be polite or don't want it to be aggressive. I think if we can inject some of these human traits in this human AI interactions and kind of taint it with some cultural aspects would be really great. You know, the way you greet a person will be different from a region to region. Would you incorporate maybe some religious aspects to it or some cultural aspects? It would be nice to see some of these specializations per regions.
Yeah, definitely. I'd love to do the test, which is, you know, talk to this chatbot. Which country do you think this chatbot is from? And yeah, like whether or not you could be like, oh, that's definitely an American chatbot. I would know, you know? Next topic that we're going to cover today is a pretty interesting one. A few episodes ago, we talked about the release of a benchmark called Frontier Math from a group called Epoch AI. And Frontier Math is fascinating, to me at least, because it is an attempt to kind of create evaluations that can keep up with how high capability these models are becoming. And so what Frontier Math is you work with a group of really kind of graduate mathematicians, kind of like professional expert mathematicians, to put together incredibly hard math problems that even they have a hard time solving. Using that as the source of the eval benchmark, right? And, you know, the intuition here is that all the classic evals, right, like MMLU or whatever, have kind of become saturated. Like no one really thinks that they give us good signal anymore on model performance. Now, I bring it up again today because there was sort of an interesting controversy that emerged where it sort of came out that OpenAI had been involved in the development of this eval and, in fact, had gotten sort of access to sort of these kind of initial test questions. And, you know, I think there's a couple of kind of responses that Epoch had. You know, one of them is that there's a holdout set, right, that the OpenAI team won't be able to get access to. There's kind of a commitment not to train on these questions, right, which might also distort the eval performance. But I kind of wanted to raise it because I think we're kind of in this interesting time where everybody knows the existing evals that are kind of the main benchmarks in the industry are kind of broken. Everybody's seeking to create better evals. And we're kind of in this new world where we're trying to work out, like, what should that look like exactly? And I guess, Gal, I want to kind of throw it to you is like, you know, how should we sort of think about the involvement of companies in developing benchmarks?
I guess the skeptical part of me would just say expect that type of back and forth between the companies and the evals and then take whatever performance gains they're advertising with a grain of salt and wait for third-party confirmations. So that's probably my largest takeaway there is it don't say it's never going to happen. In some cases, perhaps it really is great to have smart people get into the same room and break down barriers between companies and the goals of making benchmarks. But don't just take that particular company's word about how amazing their product is on arguably overfitting results. So yes, just add overall to skepticism and just kind of raise the bar a little bit on consumer education of what these kind of results really mean and make people really be appreciative of third-party confirmations.
Definitely. Because I think, I don't know, I take that. And I think that, you know, I'm a little bit sympathetic to Epoch, right? Which is, well, you want to create an eval that challenges the very best models. And part of that involves working kind of closely with the companies to design those evals. Like the worst thing is you release an eval that is completely irrelevant to actually testing any model performance at all. And so almost by necessity, there is this kind of interaction. You know, Abraham, do you kind of buy that? This is sort of like inevitable. I know I have some friends who are like, you know, church and state, right? Like Yeah. You should, you know, the eval people should never talk to the companies, which I think is, at least in my mind, is a little broken, but curious about what you think.
Yeah, I would echo the same sentiment, to be honest. I think it's evaluations and benchmarks over the last, you know, year have become less and less, I mean, not trustworthy, but transparent in terms of what they're actually using as part of their, you know, what benchmarking data makes it into the training versus, you know, what they're actually evaluating on. I think in a space like this, it really is the community that dictates the performance of the model. You're even starting to see where, you know, you'd have ubiquitous benchmarks across models. You're starting to see model providers pick and choose which benchmarks they publish versus which ones they leave out to be able to narrate the story that they want. So I think as you know, as that trend continues and as, you know, data curators work with model developers to figure out what the best way is to evaluate these models, I think it's just going to be on the community at large to be, you know, the judge, jury, in terms of, you know, is this model actually performing what the benchmarks say? Or is this another kind of, you know, gaming the system? Because a model comes out every few months and somehow every single model is better than the previous one. So kind
of calm earlier, everything is like, always state of the art.
We should have been at AGI months ago, but it's, you know, why are we not there?
Kato, I guess this kind of leaves us in a funny place, though. If we take sort of Skyler's rule, right, which is we should see all these evals with a bit of skepticism, is it true that kind of in the end, like vibes still are the best eval? Like, you know, can we trust any eval anymore? Like, it kind of leaves me in a fun place because I'm like, well, I really desperately want to have some kind of quantitative metric here, but it sort of feels like maybe that's ultimately kind of a lost game.
Yeah, I think it's a very controversial thing here. You know, what can you trust here? So there are all these benchmarks out there, but, you know, with this controversy that happened around frontier math, you can see that OpenAI has this advanced access, which raises concerns about fairness because it gives them an advantage in optimizing their models specifically for those benchmarks. And this compromises the integrity of this fair benchmarking where all the participants should start from the same baseline. So how can we fix this? Can we maybe establish some governance around, you know, these evals? Can we have some transparent access rules, some independent oversight, like a third party that makes sure that everybody has access at the same baselines and, you know, that they don't get access maybe to data that will help them tune their models for those specific use cases? And then can we have an open review process for these results? So that's going to require a lot of work, but I think it can be done. Technically, it can be done to have these third parties that are completely independent that establish a governance and write these tools and processes and so on to be able to really ensure a fair evaluation process. And I hope we get to that at some point because what can you trust? And you have to do these evaluations sometimes yourselves. And I think maybe the community can also contribute to all of these evaluations and provide more validation.
Yeah, I think the incentives are kind of a little bit interesting here too, because I think, you know, Epoch gets burned in this story, but OpenAI gets burned as well, right? Because like it's not a great look in some ways. And I feel like, you know, almost there's incentive to like be as hands-off as possible. Because look, when O3 comes out, I really do believe it will be better at very hard math, right? Like I think there is actually some genuine signal here, but like where we are now is maybe a little bit, you know, happens in the shadow of, oh, well, we know this arrangement and they had access and all that.
I mean, the jump was pretty significant in the benchmark. I think it went from before the 01 results, it was, I believe, 2%, and it jumped to 25% with 01 results.
That's right. Exactly.
Well, that's a big jump.
Yeah, the question is like how much of that delta
exactly.
is the model, right? Yeah. And how much of it is, you know, being able to kind of study for the test, basically. Yeah.
And I think there was also someone, I think Sholay, the creator of the ARC AGI benchmark, he refuted OpenAI's claim of exceeding human performance. You know, he highlighted, you know, that O3 still struggles with some of the basic tasks. So then, you know, it remains, you know, what do you trust? You know, is it really a 25% leap here compared to the 2%? Or maybe there are still some gaps that they're not telling the full story.
So yeah, I think we're going to have to keep on this. You know, there's a great article that I saw from that just came out, I think, a few weeks back that was kind of making the observation that models are getting better, but we can't really measure how. You know, it's like we live in this kind of funny world where like all the evals kind of seem broken. We have a general strong intuition that things seem to get better, but like we have no way of actually assessing that, which I think is kind of a funny situation to be in.
Can we create an eval LLM? Or some model that, you know, evaluates all of these other models? Can we automate this evaluation process?
Yeah, I think that's kind of where we end up is like, I think if we think that e-vibes are going to be a powerful way of evaluating models. And what we really say by vibes is like, an interactive evaluation. Like you talk with the model to get a better understanding. It seems very intuitively obvious to me that at some point you will end up with like, well, to scale that, we need LLMs talking to LLMs. And that kind of like they're conducting a scaled vibes eval. I don't know where that goes, but it kind of feels like that's like maybe one set of research paths that you go down.
You might be onto something.
Yeah, we'll see.
Vibes eval.
I just host this show. Someone else needs to do that work. So for our final topic today, we're going to talk about a report that came out of the research group IDC about generalist versus specialized coding assistants. And it was released just earlier this month, I believe. So the report kind of takes a look at, you know, what programmers are getting out of coding assistants. And they show a lot of the results that I think we are familiar with at this point. So they report that 91% of developers are using coding assistants. They say that 80% of those developers are seeing productivity increases, with the mean productivity increasing by 35%. So all kind of the good news that we're used to, which is that these coding assistants really do seem to be helping people along and doing better at their job as software engineers. I think the really interesting thing, though, that they make a distinction on is between generalist and specialized coding assistants. So generalists are basically like overall coding help, with specialized assistants focusing on specific programming language, specific frameworks, industry-specific requirements. And they kind of make the distinction that these are actually like two different markets. And right now, like you kind of need both to do coding assistance. And I guess maybe the question, you know, maybe I'll throw it to you, Abraham, first is like, you know, I always thought that like where we're headed with these coding assistants is that there will just be one coding assistant model to rule them all. But it is kind of interesting to me. They seem to be making the argument that like, no, there's going to be these really interesting niches for like, you know, my joke is like the Fortran model, right? It's just like just specific to this particular use case. Is that what you guys are seeing at Granite? Like, I'm kind of curious because I know you've done a fair amount of coding work.
I agree, at least in the current space right now, you know, the perfect world, there would be, you know, a one ring that fits all, like, you know, that rules
one ring that fits all
kind of methodology. But here at IBM, you know, we support we develop our resource-specific languages. And the reason behind that, there are these legacy applications, you know, COBOL Z, where it's a low-resource language. There's not a ton of, you know, data that we can use to be able to train our models, where if we were to start to bake it into our more general code model, some of the capabilities might get lost in terms of being able to support that use case. So we find that, you know, you do have these legacy systems that people are still on where, you know, resource support might not be as prominent as it was 5, 10, 15 years ago, where you do need to backfill some of the work with, you know, code assistance. And then you do have your larger, more general models that support, you know, your more widely used languages. So in our space, we really do have that two-prong approach in terms of how we develop our code models. And of course, you know, the ultimate goal is to start to consolidate into something that can fit everything. But right now, that's just not the case.
So I guess your prediction is that we will actually just see, like, this is temporary and we will see the merger. Like, generalists will become specialized at some point.
You know what? I'm trying not to make predictions in this space because everything changes.
Yeah,
so
I think
fast.
It's hard.
But what I will say is that there's a shift in workforce specifically around, you know, capabilities. So I think that for organizations that need to be able to maintain their environment, they will look for models that help that. And if that can be provided as a part of a general model, all the better. But I think right now it's still looking to be more of a specialist model focus.
Skylar, do you want to talk a little bit about, I mean, the interesting kind of labor impact of all this? You know, I was joking with a friend recently. I was like, what you really need to do now, talking about the Fortran code assistant, is like you need to specialize in languages that no one programs in anymore, right? Because if you do Python, you do, you know, any of the popular languages, you're about to get wiped out because the models are going to get really good really fast. And so the main thing is to flee into like what weird, obscure version of Haskell, you know, and kind of that's your defensive moat if you're a coder. Is that good advice or is that just crazy?
that's a great anecdote. And I think actually it's not just a story. I do think actually IBM's got a lot of vested interest in keeping some of those old languages up and running. So beyond just a punchline, I think here's a great breakdown. And as part of this this survey that was done from the IDC, they also said what particular tools or what particular tasks do you use these assistants for? And at the top of the list was unit test case generation. So this is like the really boring part of software engineering, writing all these unit tests to try to, you know, break your code. So in that sense, I would say to your friend, don't specialize in building unit tests. That is something that I think machines are doing a great job of, and people are already leveraging for that task. But at the bottom of this list of where they aren't using these tools as much is code explanation, which is, now if I copy in a set of this code, can I have an LLM tell me what this code is doing? So I think there's this really cool breakdown between what tasks software developers really want to be automated for them, things like coding up unit tests, and other areas where they actually need to, you know, use kind of higher level processing of, ooh, what is this code doing? Can I explain what this code is doing to somebody else? And that kind of breakdown here of how at least software developers in the US are currently using tools, I think represents that gap. So to your friends, don't tell them to specialize in unit test generations, but maybe have them skill up a little bit on the ability to explain what that code is doing, because that's something that currently the AI assistants, at least, are not being used for.
I see the future as an AI co-creation software developers. So where the future of programming will involve human-AI collaboration with AI as a coding assistant, helping to brainstorm, optimize, and refine solutions. But going to your friend, I think where they should focus on is areas where AI struggles. Things like system design, security and handling edge cases, creative problem solving. So, it's responsible AI use cases. Those are still areas where AI struggles, because I think designing and solving and programming complex software systems involves not just coding, but a lot of other elements and angles here, and especially the collaborative nature of understanding the end user's requirements, the client edge cases, the requirements, the security implications, all of that, and putting it all together in a full end-to-end solution with testing, with coding, so there are lots of elements here that still AI cannot handle completely, and software developers are still needed. But I think they need to focus more on those situations that AI struggles with, but of course enhance their productivity with these code assistants and co-pilots.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, I don't know, Skylar's emphasis, I think, on like, don't do unit tests, but work on explaining the code, I think is very interesting. Classically, documentation is always terrible for any software. And I guess, Skylar, kind of what you're saying is, maybe that's actually where the future is. Like, you really got to get better at that soon.
I was actually having a conversation with a former coworker, and I don't want to date him, but when he was in computer science, when he was doing his grad school in computer science, he said they didn't code. They just, their goal was to think about how to strategically, outline your code and what's the thought process behind building it, as opposed to just going and building. And he recently took on a new role in a new space, and he's had to learn a new language. And it was funny. He was saying, I don't have to build code anymore. I think the gap that I see with a lot of these, PhDs coming out is they don't have to build code, but they're never taught how to think through and explain why we're doing what we're doing. So he found it a lot easier to actually learn, given that that was kind of where he started. So to your point, Skylar, it was he's actually seeing that the better you can actually structure your code in your head before you actually start to write it, the easier it is to learn.
I agree with you, Abraham. I think the problem solving process, how do you decompose a problem into sub-problems? And also the algorithms. Think understanding, how to create a very innovative algorithm. This is something, that requires deeper thinking, deeper expertise that probably AI cannot solve today. Like coming up with a new algorithm that solves something some of the existing problems. So it's still challenging for an AI system to do.
Well, let that be a lesson to, or a word of advice to all you coders out there who are listening to the show. As always, I say this every single episode, but we are out of time for all the things that we need to talk about. Thank you for joining us, Abraham. We'll have you back on the show. Kowtar, as always, and Skylar, thanks for coming on. And thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we will see you next week on Mixture of Experts.